Hello everyone and welcome to RadChat, the multi-award winning first therapeutic radiolog for lead oncology podcast. Welcome to podcast number 126. My name is Namanjoka Anderson and I'm joined by fellow host Joe McNamara.
Hi everyone.
So a big thank you to our last guest, Judith Epitour, who discussed her experience of cancer and the community group From Me to You, The Art of Survival that she founded. If you hadn't had a chance yet, please do go and take a listen. So we're very pleased to introduce our guest this evening, Dr. Alison Berner, who will be discussing her career, gender identity clinic work, and PhD research. Hi, Alison, how are you?
Hi, I'm really well, thank you.
Would you mind by starting and telling us about your current role and how you got there, please?
Of course. So I am an NIHR academic clinical lecturer. I'm based at Barts Cancer Institute, Queen Mary University of London, and I'm in my final year of training as an ST6. So I've just finished my breast rotation and I'm about to finish up on lung. I also work one day a week at the Gender Identity Clinic, seeing adults, and that's part of the Tavistock and Portman NHS Foundation Trust. And I lead the UCAT service, which stands for UK Cancer and Transition Service, and that is operated through TransPlus Chelsea Westminster.
Why did you want to be in oncology?
Oh, that's a great question. So I was really lucky. I went to a very bog standard comprehensive school in East London, and after my GCSE results, the then director, who is about to step down, of Barts Cancer Institute spotted me in the newspaper and said, would you like to come and do some work experience? Which was incredible because I didn't have anybody in my family who had done medicine. And so I got to go and watch a clinical academic oncologist at the bench and seeing patients. And I was sold. And I did try to think about doing other things, but I realised I loved everything from the molecular all the way up to seeing patients.
For anyone who doesn't know what a clinical academic is, what does that actually mean?
So that means that you get a split between your clinical life, so seeing patients in the hospital, and then going to the lab or sometimes to the office if you're a trialist and you don't do things at the bench, or sitting in front of a computer if you do bioinformatic work, so using big data. But basically you spend part of your time seeing your patients and part of your time doing research. It's really popular to do that with what's called translational research, where they say you go from the bench to the bedside and back. So you get ideas from seeing your patients, and then you bring that into your research, you do some research and you take that back. And that's in some ways what I'm starting to get to do with my own research, with the transgender patients that I see with cancer.
What made you start to work with trans patients?
So when I was training, I saw some examples of where the care for those patients seemed to be more centred about what ward or bay they should be in and their identity than was actually what was wrong with them. And I felt like that was something that wasn't quite right. That wasn't happening in oncology, that was in other specialties, but it really stuck with me. And then I saw an article that was around this topic in an oncology journal, and I felt this is strange because it was based more on HIV research at the time than any actual oncology research. And I felt, well, this must be a really lacking area. So I managed to get in touch with the then Gender Identity Clinic to get some more experience, and absolutely loved it. And they had some part-time jobs coming up and they thought that it would be great for me to follow that interest. And then people have just been really flexible through my research training and my clinical training to allow me to develop that specialism. And I'm pleased to say that it's not only me doing this, there are lots of people in the world doing research in the LGBTQ cancer space and in cancer care for trans patients. But I think I'm the only oncologist who's actually gone and dual trained, which I think adds a kind of extra layer of interest because I can speak both languages, if that makes sense.
Might be a controversial question, but shouldn't everyone be dual trained in something like this?
Well, I guess it's where you want to focus your expertise. I mean, I would argue we should all, to a greater or lesser extent, have a special interest and start to build a portfolio career. Wouldn't it be great if we all had a Rolodex where we knew that so-and-so in the department has really good cultural competence in this, and then so-and-so in the department, well, they've been off and done a master's in that. And I think that would be fantastic. And I would argue that actually our training needs to needs to cater more for that. I think it is increasingly, because I think all of us working in cancer care, no matter what our role, it's heavy, and I think more and more people are stepping out to do stuff. And it's interesting you spoke about Amy, who was in your last episode, because I know her too, and I didn't know that she had that role. So yeah, that's great.
Small world, isn't it? Anything to do with cancer and radiotherapy, it's small. I suppose then, looking back at your education, especially when you came into science in the medical world, have you seen LGBTQ plus education or medical education advance or change?
So there was certainly none for me. Things have improved, and actually Catherine Meads and her team at Anglia Ruskin did some work for the NHS England LGBT team, where they basically surveyed all of the undergraduate and postgraduate education in LGBTQ health, which was no small task. And a lot of what was found there was that it was a lot ad hoc rather than a stream that was running through the curriculum. And so there are individual institutions that are really embedding this. There are others that are having kind of ad hoc lectures where they invite someone who they know. There's some amazing student initiatives where they realise that there's a gap and they're inviting people in, or they're creating that education for themselves. So things have improved, but it really needs to be consistent. It's a real lottery, and as I say, it needs to be embedded, not a couple of lectures at the end of the course, but actually you need to encounter patients all the way through. In the same way, you would never go, well, I don't think now you would encounter a course where every single person in vignette that you came across was a white Caucasian person. Like, you would never. And I would like to think that we'll get to a point where there are kind of lots of intersectional identities. We'll come across different religions, we'll come across different sexual orientations, we'll come across more disability, because actually we talk about health conditions, but actually just different types of cognitive ability as well. I think it's really important.
From a patient's perspective, how do you best support them, Alison? I'm thinking about maybe people that are qualified working out in practice who maybe don't have that knowledge or haven't had that training. What would you suggest that they need to do to better support patients?
So I think there are some really good trainings that you can access that are kind of co-developed by members of the community. And so if you have access to those, I think they're great to look into. I particularly think in primary care, they have the Pride in Practice scheme, which is run by LGBT Foundation. Outpatients, which is the national cancer charity for LGBTQIA plus people, they run some fantastic training where someone can come into your organisation. But if you can't access that, I'm hoping that you will know individuals within the community where you can kind of chat things through. And if there are things you're feeling awkward about or unfamiliar with, you can ask those things. But obviously, the LGBTQ population is not a homogenous group. You can't expect someone to be necessarily an expert on everyone's identity and what's happening. You can read and educate yourself. There's lots of great books written by members of the community around health. There's a Ben Vincent's wrote an excellent, it's very short book called Transgender Health. Which if you're looking to learn more about that community, that's a real, really, really good intro, and it's not very much money. So I think just trying to get a feel for these things, remembering not to believe everything you read in popular press. I won't bad name any particular form of popular press, but there's lots of rumours. Anyone who's worked in healthcare will know, for example, that the strikes perhaps are put across in some very different ways by media compared to what we all know on the inside. It's no different with these sorts of topics, so not believing all of that, and then just being respectful and being curious and humble, and just saying, if you I don't know how, you can say, look, I don't know how to talk about this thing, could you help me? Asking things like, how would you like me to address you? What are your name and pronouns? If that's how you feel to ask it, Or I can see that someone has wrote a letter referring to you as this, is that right? Who have you brought with you today, rather than making an assumption about who that person is? Who supports you? I think that that's, for me, is a great question in oncology generally, because you could be with a heterosexual cis person and say, oh yeah, and does your husband help? And your husband does not help. And that's, you've just walked into a whole situation. So these are things that actually, if you employ them with everybody, you'll treat everybody better. It's nothing particularly different. And then control your face. People will have situations and things within their culture that might seem very alien to you. Again, that's not specific to LGBTQ communities, but if someone tells you something, if you're not used to people in non-monogamous relationships and someone starts talking about polyamory in your clinic, you know, you need to control your face. And so it's these are kind of very, very basic things. And then in terms of the if there's stuff you don't know, don't make it up, go get an expert. So don't assume someone's risk. Go find an expert, do some reading. We all have a phone a friend. Go to the literature where you can, and if you don't know, keep asking. So not making assumptions. The one I always think about is cervical screening risk. For many years, people assumed that lesbian, bisexual women didn't need a smear test. Not true. Trans men didn't need a smear test. Not true.
I really like that. Control your face. I can say that that's a polite way of saying what you're doing. How have you found engaging with other professionals, so in the wider MDT, around this sort of topics?
So I think my experience actually in many ways mirrors what has actually been seen in the literature. So there's been loads of studies done on how health professionals behave towards LGBTQ communities. There's been lots of kind of very similar and repetitive surveys, but there's been really some nice qualitative work. And I say repetitive surveys, we've also done one in the UK, because you know, you have to repeat these things to prove that they are universal. But there's so people in general are really open and interested. People will have been swayed sometimes by common media, and sometimes you have to overcome the prejudices that have been set, usually by the media, not actually by anything that anyone's been brought up with generally. People often they have, there's this phrase called the egalitarian professional, which is like, oh well, it's fine, I just treat everybody the same. It's like people saying, oh well, I don't see color. Well, that's not true, actually. And to treat people equitably is not the same as treating them equally. So you actually do need to understand where you might need to modify what you're doing, and it's difficult because there's not always space for that in the NHS. People do struggle around language. I think people, particularly some of the most experienced people, can just feel, and particularly when the NHS is busy, they're like, gosh, this is terminology and phrasing and things that I'm not familiar with, and I feel like I'm treading on eggshells, and it's uncomfortable, and we don't like being uncomfortable. So there will always be a minority, but for the most part, I've come across very little overt discrimination. It does exist, but very little, and more just, you know, it's a challenge and it's different. And if you don't have friends that are within the community, then some people find it harder, but in general, I think people are really enthusiastic. I'm really enthusiastic to be helped, and when you make it really easy for them and give them really easy to listen to stuff. And that's a lot of what I do in the education work I do, and also in the clinical service, is just being like, I'm here to hold your hand. How can I help?
You do a lot, don't you? So I did a bit of stalking, obviously, before the podcast, and I was delving into all the things you're involved in. And you support a lot of charities, a lot of organisations. Does that for you become exhausting because you are constantly having to educate people, go back through resources to update them? I'm just thinking about the toll on you and the role that you have. Do you find that people rely on you having to educate them rather than going and doing that education themselves?
I think there are a limited number of people working in this space at the moment, but there is lots of interest. And so it's not just me. It's the charity that I mentioned, Outpatients, and it's other members who are champions within their kind of subspecialty interest. And a lot of us are either very strong allies or members of the community in different ways, depending on which LGBTQ subgroup you talk about. So I wouldn't say it was just me. The problem is that when all the work needs to be done, you feel like it's a moral imperative. So it's not so much that it's exhausting, but it's when something doesn't work out, it's personal. When someone makes a challenge on trans health, it's not personal to me in the sense that I'm not trans, but it's personal to me in that that's my friends, you know, and my patients and my, you know, that's quite challenging. And if it's the wider LGBTQ community, I'm bi, so that is a personal attack. And people say these things are not important, and it is a personal attack. So there is that. I think so. It's less exhausting and more. It's like, how do we spread ourselves? And you don't want to turn down an opportunity, because you also know that for this topic, as much as there is some negative attention, we're also on the creative curve, and it's the time to build on funding and to make the most of the interest to get the work in and to get projects funded. So I think that's what's tiring. And for me, trying to stay in academia, there is a funnel of the next step for me is like, I've got to get through the funnel into a fellowship and then I'm safe. And so it's how much time do I devote to helping other organisations versus working on my own research. Therefore, I still don't have a PhD manuscript. My PhD was in cancer genomics. I am still working on it, but yeah, it's been an incredibly slow process because of doing all of these other things, because it ends up being less of the moral imperative. I'm sure it's going to be a great manuscript, but it's entirely unrelated to LGBTQ health.
I suppose it's just highlighting, though, how important finding what you love and what you like in work is, because while you still need to push on with your career and do what you need to do, exactly as you said with the trainee stuff, you still need to find stuff that you like to make sure you're motivated to do the day job.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I love genomics too, and part of the pleasure of what I'm doing now is that actually my USP is that, again, I speak both languages. So now there are some areas where we've kind of done some slightly fluffy science related to, say, cancer risk in trans folks. And now I'm like, well, actually, now it's time for the hard science. Now we can actually work out what's actually going on rather than just sort of assuming. So that's the dream.
Can you talk to us a little bit about your genomics? Because it is an area that everyone is really keen to learn more about. I know for Numan and I, we had Mike Merchant on, who basically had an engineer career and then came into kind of physics, dosimetry, and some of the stuff he's doing around kind of the radiation response as a result of genomics is just, it just blows your mind, the fact that potentially in the future you can look at someone's DNA and specifically see what treatment pathway they should have. That just blows my mind. But what are you doing specifically?
I love genomics, and it's another way to personalise cancer care, isn't it? So I, you know, in LGBTQ health, we're talking about the macro, whereas this is the micro. So my PhD was in these long-term exceptional survivors of colorectal cancer, and i.e. trying to work out what made them special from a genomic perspective, and then working out what happened to all of these to these cancers over hugely long periods of time, so how they were evolving. So this was in a kind of cancer and evolution lab. So how was the genome evolving, and did actually the transcriptome, so the bit that's made out of the DNA, the RNA, how did that actually change, and did that change in the same way, and what's happening across time. So that's that. And then I have a separate project which is kind of in its infancy at the moment, but to look at colorectal cancer genomes, but from the perspective of sex differences. So we know there's differences in incidence of colorectal cancer depending if you're a cisgender man or a cisgender woman, and some of that we think might be related to your chromosomes, and some of it is probably related to how much estrogen you have on board. How, you know, if you're a cisgender woman when you started your periods, when you went through the menopause, and then actually also you'll have estrogen on board if you're male, so it could relate to your BMI. And again, there's some, all of the information on that so far, and that risk is come from epidemiological studies. And then that's not quite yet married up with what's happening on the genome level. So my, again, this project is to try to make those two things make sense. I don't know why I keep coming back to talking different languages. I just like putting strange things together, don't I? Or making me realise this pattern of my career.
Showing off, Alison. Showing us how intelligent you are. Joe's literally just texted me that as well, so...
No, or how to make one's life difficult in 5 easy steps. That's what.
If that's what you want to call it, that's fine.
So my partner says, she says, most people try to work out how they can earn as much money as possible by doing as little as possible, whereas you seem to be committed to doing as much as possible for the same amount of money.
I know it sounds crazy, but you must think that, you know, with your interests and the fact that, you know, you're able to spread yourself across lots of different topics, you must never be bored, ever.
No, I'm definitely never bored. I'm really not. In fact, it really annoys me when people say they're bored. I'm like, how? How do you not have a 10-point to-do list? And then 5 films that you want to watch, and also, but you want to be out dancing or doing whatever. Yeah, I'm literally like that all the time.
So Alison, do you want to talk us through the Gender Identity Clinic?
Yes. So I work in the Adult Gender Identity Clinic as what we call at the Tavistock a core clinician. So that means that I am assessing individuals for readiness for hormones or surgeries. It's quite different to oncology. You get to spend an hour with every patient, which is an absolute treat. So you find out everything about somebody. And essentially it's that you're ensuring that they can provide an informed consent and that they're kind of ready, and there's nothing that's going to cause them problems later down the line, like a health condition or the fact they haven't had a chance to explore this with family or try it out in a social role. So that's that. And then we have separate referrals on for surgery. We do have a specialist endocrinology, but the basic prescribing is all done by clinicians like myself. And then, as you kind of alluded to earlier about this having kind of a second interest, we all have our own interests within the core clinicians. So some of them will be psychiatrists, and so people with particular mental health difficulties that are quite extreme might be seen by them. We have general practitioners, we have sexual health, and then very separate to that is the UK Cancer and Transition Service, this UCATS clinic, where we also have up to an hour with every patient, but there our role is getting that patient and all of their clinicians into the room, including their clinicians at their gender identity clinic and their clinicians in the oncology space or their GP or palliative care or whoever it might be, to talk through how, say, for example, that decision about hormones or surgery might interact with all of the other things going on in their care, because you want for them to be able to give informed consent and make decisions. You need to hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak, and if their clinician can't be in the room, then we do some liaising beforehand, but it's helping with those really complicated decisions, because for the health professionals listening, how many times have you ever been in an MDT and the person says, well, I think we should do this, or if the patient isn't well enough, then we should do that. So then you end up having another appointment to find out if the patient is well enough. If the person's in the room, then you have the answer.
Can I ask, Alison, what are waiting times like? You know, are people having to face quite long periods of time before they even get to be seen in the clinic?
So in gender identity services generally, yes, they're very long, and some of them are up to 5 years, I think, at this point. Essentially, the gender identity services that we have currently were designed with a population of trans folks that is 10 times less than is actually the case now. So the census proved that the population is 10 times more than the services we planned for. So that is the issue. And obviously we don't want to bias people's care by rushing people. There are a number of gender identity pilot services, which are slowly being commissioned into full services to help improve the numbers that we have at the moment. The pilot services take individuals from the waiting lists of the other clinics to try to help, so they don't have clinics of their own. If this is a topic that interests people, the wait times are actually regularly updated by a fantastic kind of community resource called Gender Construction Kit, which tells you a lot of kind of the basics around gender affirming care, and I think it's a really useful educational resource if people are trying to educate themselves. And I guess that's another reason for UCATS, and I would argue that actually for a lot of other medical specialties we should have this too, in that if wait times are long, sometimes you need an additional service to help people make decisions, or to help them, if need be, jump the queue, if that's what's medically needed, into other services. Or because as soon as people are finished with the gender affirming care they want, then they're discharged from a gender identity clinic. So where do you get that expertise from later? Because you're not going to be referred back for that. So that's where the need comes in. A hat that I haven't mentioned is that I'm president of the British Association of Gender Identity Specialists. So one of my jobs is to think about publishing some standards, which we're working on, to try to say to the NHS, this is the sort of service that you need to commission.
When you said adult services, what age does that start?
So it starts from age 18, but people are referred onto our waiting list usually from 17 and a half. But yeah, we won't see anybody until they are 18. Obviously, there is a huge and very complex situation going on with the children's services and the gender identity development services. And that needs to be resolved as quickly as possible, because those are life-saving services, literally. And we in adult services see the results of individuals who have not been able to access appropriate support when they were young people. And the result can be really devastating for an individual, and they're left with problems that continue to haunt them all the way through adulthood. And so as soon as that situation is resolved, the better, I think.
Can I ask, Alison, I don't know if you can answer this, but how do you know as a professional or a clinician or an ally that you have given someone gender affirming care?
So gender affirming care is a kind of catch-all for the interventions that help lower someone's sense of gender dysphoria, so that sense of discomfort with their own body, or with the way that the world genders them. So it's almost defined by it's defined by the individual of what they find affirming, and that's really important, because it used to be that there was sort of a set there was thought to be this kind of set model that you had to work through. You were supposed to have hormones, and then you were supposed to have, if you were a trans guy, you were supposed to have your top surgery, so surgery that removes some but not all of the breast tissue and creates a masculinized chest, and then you would have your lower surgery. Was actually, that's not how it works. It's more of a pick and mix. It's what causes you the discomfort with your body, or the way that the world genders you. And you also, well, that will always be a trade-off for you, because what if you, someone that really is averse to having surgery, what's worse, the fear of the surgery or the dysphoria? So it's very much unique to each individual, and the dysphoria varies. It can go up, it can go down. So people are have best described it to me, it's a bit like the electrical buzz when you go into a room. If you're in the middle of a party or chatting away to your friends, you're not going to notice. You're trying to sleep at night, it's loud as hell, and it's a bit like that. And it can vary through your life. So it might feel very imperative to have one intervention at one point. Later on in life, it might not seem quite so. People's sense of their gender does also change. There's a lot of talk in the media, and I don't want to go into it, around detransition. But detransition doesn't mark a failure of anyone involved. For some people, their gender really does fluctuate, and actually they may not regret what they did earlier. So because these things do fluctuate, and we don't understand it enough, because for a long time it was so unacceptable that people wouldn't tell us. You're not going to go and tell the gender identity clinic who essentially you feel like you're having to bargain with to get the care you want, that you might not be 100% sure. So there's a lot we still don't know, because we've not been great in health at gaining trust, and we've not been very open and accepting of identities. And slowly that is changing, but it will be very slow because the community is still afraid, to be completely honest, with gender identity services. And so a lot of what I spend the first 15 minutes of every clinic appointment letting people understand that actually I'm not here to take a checklist about your identity and for you to prove to me that you're ready for something. This is about getting to know you and working out what's right for you as an individual.
Did you have to have any training, Alison, around kind of supporting patients? And I would imagine you do quite a lot of counselling as well, just in talking to patients. Is that something that you've had to kind of go out and seek, or is that something that you've learned through your interactions with patients?
So you sort of learn it. It's all on the job training. There is a separate credential from the Royal College of Physicians that people do, where there's like a curriculum and then some in practice training. But I was in the system before that occurred, so I'd be grandfathered in. But yeah, you do a certain amount of observation, and then you do a lot of observed assessments, and then you go out yourself. I also do a lot of learning from other organisations, attend other CPD, not as much, I have to say, as I would like, as much kind of listening to and working with community groups, asking colleagues at other gender identity services what they do. And there's also a sense when you do go into training at any of the gender identity clinics, you get a feel for if someone is the right sort of person that lends themselves into doing these things and having these conversations quite easily. I also I think I'm a bit of like almost like a psychologist on the side. Like, I've always had a bit of an interest, so I listen to a lot of like sort of psychology, self-development, and then a lot of like literature from people with lived experience while I don't know vacuuming or whatever. So I sort of do my referral off to the real psychologists and psychiatrists in the clinic, and I've got no idea what they think about my things. They're probably like, she's an idiot, this is not at all what's wrong with this person, or this is not at all the type of therapy this person needs. But yeah, people seem to find it helpful.
Hi everyone. So we wouldn't be able to do what we do without some sponsorship and help from some amazing people. So we've just got a short advert here coming up, just so that you can hear some of the products from one of the sponsors that have supported us right from the start.
We have an incredibly exciting time at OSL at the moment, with new products within our portfolio coming to the market. One new product is ClearSight Bolus, completely translucent, semi-adhesive and compatible with surface-guided radiotherapy solutions. Another product is the IBA Microwave Proactive System, the only commercial prospective risk management solution for radiation oncology. You'll find much more information about this on our website. If you would like to browse our products, please go to our website at www.osl.uk.com, or if you would like to speak to us, please call 01743 462 694.
Alison, if the health minister suddenly said you have a blank check, what would you want in this area?
Oh, I would like better kind of services, supported services outside of just gender affirming care, to help kind of join that up with people where they are, so that eventually we can adopt this sort of hub and spoke model to deliver gender affirming care everywhere. And then the final thing I think I would want is proper investment in sexual orientation and gender identity monitoring, because there's a lot that we don't know, and we can't employ it without it. A lot of actually the community work has been done, but we can't employ it without training everybody how to ask the questions and where to record it and where to put it in registries, and then we would understand the scale of the inequalities, and then there's a lot more that we could do. But a lot of time in research in this space at the moment is actually like spent trying to like back office link data to work out what's going on with people, which is a huge waste when that same research funding could be driven to the front end, and then we'd have the answers forever.
Dr. Alison Berner for Health Secretary, I reckon. after that answer.
It's a poison chalice. It's a poison chalice.
I definitely want to share this podcast episode with my husband, who thinks I'm a workaholic. I want to let him listen to you, Alison, and all that you do, so that he realises that I don't do anything.
I'm surrounded by them, so I feel like I don't do anything either. The thing is, we're here. When I was listening to Matt Naman speak, I was also feeling like a complete imposter. Anyone I know working in this space, or even the genomic space, you talk about people coming from different backgrounds. People have been physicists, statisticians, engineers. Yeah, I think you surround yourself with people who are like-minded. So, you know, that's how we got put in touch.
Alison, what's next for you? I'm almost scared to ask this, because God only knows what you're going to say. But you must have like an idea of where you see your career pathway, and maybe like aspirations for the future.
Yeah, I thought about this a bit, because I'm lucky enough to benefit from some mentorship through my clinical lecturer job. So I need to write my PhD manuscript. That is step one. And then I need to write a fellowship, which is step two. So I'd like to apply for like a clinician scientist or advanced level fellowship with one of the big funders, so that I would then work in oncology probably a day a week, gender and cancer a day to half a day a week, and then the rest of the time in research, because the clinical work will always take up more space than it does. Essentially run studies, clinical studies and translational studies, that better determine cancer kind of risk and cancer care according to sexual orientation, gender identity, and sex assigned at birth. Because I'm kind of interested in the big questions for cisgender populations as well. And I think the better we understand what's going on cis populations, we'll understand trans populations and vice versa. So I think we can do this to the benefit of everybody. So that's the sort of next step. And then longer term, I want the research that I do to change practice and policy. And so kind of later on down the line, I do see myself moving into a kind of policy position, whether it's in a funder or within the NHS. But I think that needs to come with some gravitas. So with, you know, a certain amount of clinical experience and a certain amount of research experience. And I hope by that point there'll be so many people working in this area that it won't feel such the moral imperative to stay in it and be planning 700 studies. I put a grant in last week for something that it was never even in the stratosphere. If you'd asked me 6 months ago if I was doing it, I would have told you no. I keep getting waylaid, so I don't know when I'll quite get there, but we'll see.
Alison, how do you unwind from work?
Great question. I love dancing. I love Latin dancing. So I do bachata, salsa and kizomba. So you would have found me on a bachata dance floor last night. I'm also very into working out. So I've already been for 2 fitness classes today, one this morning and one directly before this podcast. Just because I think use it or lose it. I like yoga. I make sure I meditate. And then I'm a big extrovert. So, you know, if there's somewhere where there's sort of going out for drinks, party, whatever, then I can just shut it all off and completely let my hair down when I need to. But I like to do it best when I know that I've done a job. You know, when I like, so I submitted my grant on Thursday and then I had my weekend. So, yeah.
I think I can speak for everyone listening to this. I'm feeling very inspired and like, I don't know, I feel like I need to go and do some Latin dancing or something as well, just to top it off.
You will not regret it. It's like, it's because it's not, it would be, it's more work if you're a leader, but if you're a follower, it's fantastic because your brain is off and you're just responding to being led. And it's, for me, it is the only time in my life where I am not, I'm not the boss. Someone else is the boss. And that is incredibly revitalizing for me. It's just like, I'm just like, nope, you can tell me what to do for a change. I can lead a little bit, but it's much less pleasurable.
Good. I'm going to let anyone else listening to this read between the lines.
Why is it I can't get through a podcast without saying something that sounds like a euphemism?
I think when we met, you did a few as well, so I had to get something in.
I did. I was once on an episode of a documentary about my previous secondary school with a famous person, and I even did it, and then it was broadcast on like live TV. It's very embarrassing. I'm hoping that someone's destroyed the tape.
I bet you it's on YouTube. Joe, we're going to have to find it and put it in the show notes.
It was so long ago, I'm not sure putting things on YouTube was that popular.
Well, to finish, Alison, you've given us loads of top tips, but is there anything else you would give to maybe patients or people who are maybe not as open to this sort of area?
Yeah, so I think just going back to the things I said, don't make assumptions, be humble, be willing to be, yeah, to be educated and just ask those open questions. And to patients, the majority of healthcare professionals that you see, they really just want to give you the best care. So, you know, don't be afraid. And if you aren't getting the care that you feel that you deserve, also take your you know, if you can, take your business elsewhere, and make sure that you do make a point about it, because if it's not commented on, then things won't improve. And get involved in research. There's lots of exciting research coming, and we really, really want to have really good representation from minority populations.
Thank you very much. As I said earlier, feeling very inspired. So thank you very much for coming on as a guest.
Yeah, you're really welcome. It was a pleasure to have this chat.
Thank you everyone for listening to RadChat. So your hosts today have been Namanjoka Anderson and Joe McNamara. If you're utilising this podcast for CPD purposes, consider the reflective questions posted, along with links to resources and literature we've discussed. To receive your accredited CPD certificate, please complete the form linked with the podcast. So our next guest to feature will be Ellie Crawley, who will be talking about the sustainable fitness company Feel Fit she started to help people live better and longer. Thank you for listening and take care.